latter second half of Romans 13. Verse 8, I guess, is where we're at. I wanted to just very briefly, because we went through it, and I think we dealt with it sufficiently to really understand of doing an analysis of Romans. So I don't really want to get through and talk about the more of the government submission, how the Christians interact. We kind of dealt with that, I think, thoroughly. But it did come up this week in our news cycle. What doesn't come up in the news cycle anymore in a week? That one of the not leading at all. One of the Democratic candidates for president mentioned when asked a question, he thought that his policy was that all religious organizations that didn't, or nonprofits of any sort that did not affirm not just in anywhere, but in their own belief system, that the full inclusion of LGBT rights and marriage and all that stuff, that they should lose their tax exempt status, which was unique about that, was not that somebody said that, people have been saying that for years. What was unique about that in the news cycle was, first of all, that this is a presidential candidate. That's usually not something the presidential candidate is wade into the waters of, because that alienates a huge portion of those who you want to vote for you. Usually they just kind of dance around that issue instead of being so direct with it. That was one of the unique things. The other unique thing is that none of the other candidates, Democratic candidates, condemned that, which was also a unique thing. Usually they were all silent about it, which leads many to think, well, this is the Democratic agenda idea. This is their agenda, that this is what they want. But then there's all sorts of people out there saying, well, why should churches even have tax-exempt status in the first place? People that aren't in that persuasion, just people saying, what's that even about? And what do you do if the church does lose its tax-exempt status because of those sorts of things? And so this whole issue of the church, religion and the state, which we were talking about the last couple of weeks in Romans 13, is once again brought front and center in the national conversations even this past week. It's always going to be an issue. It's constantly brought front and center. Now, the first thing that doesn't give me any concern, that I don't have concern, is this candidate who said that's been polling at less than 1%. So it's not like this is even a mainstream candidate anymore for president. So it's not like this is policy. So you can't start panicking about a person whose campaign is losing and they're trying to be provocative to get attention. You can't let that's what's going to happen. That's where we're going. You could say the opposite for Christianity, for religious freedom. Was recently a good blow was given to the other side recently when a group of atheists, an atheist organization that had been combating the concept of a church housing allowance for pastors, they've been fighting that in the Supreme Court courts for years, trying to say that's unconstitutional. The Supreme Court a month ago, was going to hear the case. Well, they were hearing the case. Well, this atheist group completely dropped their case. And because they dropped their case and it was at the Supreme Court, it's not going to be brought again. I mean, they dropped it because they found out there was no chance of winning. So when people bring up one issue and they panic in the politics, oh no, what's going to happen this? You can actually sometimes see on the other side, there still is a great freedoms we experience and great benefits. But going back to this tax-exempt thing, I'm not talking about politics so much this morning, it's just how we would interact with such a thing. First of all, as Christians, we have to understand, as humans, not Christians, citizens, we have to understand that the government gives us nothing in tax rebates, right? That's the way the question's always posed. Why should the government be giving these churches these tax rebates, these tax exemptions, as if the government's doing a favor by not stealing your money? So that's the first thing. I was like, people the fact that churches are tax exempt is not the government doing religion a favor. But that's the more political side of it. From the faith side of it, the believing side of it, the reason why is because we thank God in our country, unlike what Paul dealt with in Rome, we thank God in our country that early on, our founders understood that there are two spheres of God's directions, two spheres of leadership in the world, the government sphere and the church sphere. And they're not supposed to, the government is not supposed to punish or penalize or direct the belief system of the sphere, because they had a general respect for God, had a general respect for the concept that there was a creator and that there was a sphere that they were not interested in crossing into. And we know that that has changed drastically in our culture. For example, not that long ago, no matter what church it was, even in our culture, it was considered to be a thing where a church was a sacred place, a cathedral or a church or whatever religion was. And even there's still vestiges of that where governments do try to stay away from causing certain belief practices in church in America. I'm not talking about in the world. I mean, outer world, other countries. That respect is that idea of that there is a God, as the idea of God has diminished, right? So has the idea that there is any value to the religious sphere in our world. They just don't see there being any value, because as far as they are concerned, what we do on Sunday, what we live, is lunacy. And so they can't understand why anybody would even get why church tax exemption. Why would you do that? It's lunacy. So what does the Christian's response to things like, if you don't toe the line socially in our social order ideas, you'll lose your tax-exempt status? First of all, that would be devastating to many churches. Every year here at Grace, we would owe a tax bill of about $10,000 to $15,000 on just for property taxes. Income taxes we wouldn't have to pay in, because even if that happened, because that's not something that, it's not income, it's donation based. But property taxes, in many small churches, could not carve out $10,000 to $15,000 out of their budget a year. It would devastate many. It would also, we know, it'd devastate all these nonprofit religious hospitals, all these orphanages. I mean, it would be really devastating. That's why I don't think it would really happen, because that's still a huge voting block in our country of people that are involved in sort of nonprofit work. But what does a Christian do? How are they supposed to, with Romans 13, how are they supposed to interact with this? First of all, there is this response I saw on one side, on the religious side, is like, why do we even care? Take away our tax exempt status. Jesus said he'll build his church. The gates of hell will not prevail against it. We don't care what the government does. We're going to keep doing the preaching, the gospel, and the ministry. True. But I have a hard time believing the apostles wouldn't have said, you mean you have an opportunity to be able to use your resources for gospel advancement instead of giving it to the pagan government? I think you ought to vote for that guy. I mean, I think that's what the apostles would think, right? You ought to try to take advantage of everything you can to get the gospel out legally within the laws. So what do we do as Christians? First of all, because we submit to the government, if they rescind, for example, tax-exempt status in order to attempt to coerce against Bible teaching, you pay your taxes and you smile, just as Romans 13 says, right? As a church, we go, okay, guess we'll have to figure out a way in the budget to pay it. In other words, we don't fight. That's the idea. We're not antagonistic. We're not fighting. But if given opportunity to contrast that, to say, no, that's not good, why would we not, as Christians, want to speak up against things that are abuses that hinder gospel work? So there is a balance. I'm just saying, because this kind of injected itself in our culture this week, and I was thinking through the government and the role, and I was thinking, can't there be both, where you submit to the government as God commands while still taking every opportunity that God gives in influencing and encouraging and in using the means God has given you in order to further the gospel? This is a balance of Romans 13 with also what Paul submit with also what Paul says in 1 Timothy, where he says, pray for those in leadership so that we may lead quiet and peaceful lives with all godliness and sincerity. In other words, pray that they'll stay out of our lives so that we, the gospel, will not be hindered in any way. That balance is important that we strike as Christians. So just thought it was a good opportunity to think through quick application of this issue of how you do both. You submit, but you still can promote the biblical use of government. Right. And by the way, I agree. And I think that if you get on the, if you're in the interwebs at all, there are a lot of people who are doing a really good job of that sort of thing out there. So I think, yes, I agree. I think where the problem comes in is that people don't understand that you can do both. They feel like it's one or the other. You give yourself wholeheartedly to a political agenda, or else you say nothing and do nothing. And it's, I don't think that's the biblical call here in Romans 13. It's like, well, roll over. The government's going to do what they're going to do. Nor is it that, you know, Paul's going to go down. He's going to go down. He's going to stand up and he's brought before the people and say, I want to talk to you about Caesar's unjust tax laws. Like, that's not what he did, right? And that's the balance. That it's not. That's not our call. That's not our mission. But we certainly, I believe, don't have to ignore that there is biblical truth in how government should function. And we ought to be saying that without fear and without feeling like we're getting political. So yes, I appreciate that comment. All right, let's jump over to the, because he's moving from our relationship to government now in Romans 13 to our relationship to the world at large. And we see once again kind of why we would say this. First of all, we know that in verses 1 through 7, that he's obviously talking about the church's responsibility to, something just happened here. I don't know if it was me. I think it was me. Sorry. The church's responsibility to government, which are obviously unbelievers for the most part, right? So now he hasn't switched to going back to our relationship to believers primarily, or our believers only, but he's now talking again about, okay, now how do you love your neighbor? How do you live in a pagan environment? How do you live in a world that is hostile to you and what you believe, hostile to the truth? So that's what 8 through 14 is really about. He's going to jump over in chapter 14 and 15, how do you live in relationships with people, particularly Christians, who are your brothers, but they're hostile to some of your opinions? And talk about how you interact with differences and how you see the scripture and how you see application. So he's really talking about relationally in 12, 13, 14, 15, relationships. These relationships. And here's what he says at the beginning. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who has loves another has fulfilled the law. This is the heading of what he's going to talk about. You can see, look on down to the end, the last command he gives on this line, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And what very obvious word is connecting the first phrase in the line from this last phrase in the line? Love, right? The wrong thing there, sorry. Love, love. What other word is kind of interesting here with what you see? What do you see when he reads through this, when we read this? For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. If there's any other commandment, are summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbors yourself. These are all quotes, right? What are they from? The Ten Commandments, otherwise known as the law, right? So he's going to go to the Old Testament moral law to talk about love. Now, we as Christians, we should understand that because Jesus explained that, right? That the whole law, he says, is contained in two commandments. What were the two commandments Jesus said the whole law hangs on? Okay, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, might, mind. Yeah, several different ones. Add different words in there. And then the second, love your neighbor as yourself. He doesn't bring up the first one here, does he? Why does he not bring up the two great commandments? Paul, I'm talking about. Why does he bring up just one? Right, because he's talking about these relationships. It's not that he doesn't believe in the first great commandment. He's just, that's not the sphere that he's addressing. He's addressing how that second great commandment affects our relationships with others. And it has to be motivated and driven by love. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. That very powerful and often disobeyed commandment that we have, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. Right, and that's kind of one of the very interesting things he's saying here at the beginning. He says, people often quote this verse, and that's fine to quote it with an intention or a discussing about debt. I mean, that's part of it. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. And a lot of people have used this, and they've used it to discuss the concept of, well, we shouldn't take out loans. We shouldn't owe somebody anything. He says, owe no one anything. Where there is an application there that he is saying, I believe, don't extend yourself in such a way that you are unable to love one another. Well, if you're so overwhelmed with material things and you're, in this, they didn't have mortgages in this day, okay? So when we're talking about borrowing, you're thinking of the idea of borrowing from your neighbor, right? They didn't have banks like this. So the context he's talking about where you become a servant to your neighbor financially. That's what he's describing contextually here, right? Because that's how you borrowed money in that day. You borrowed from your neighbor. So not a professional banking type industry he's talking about. What I'm saying is we shouldn't just try to take this verse and then transport it into 21st century economy. It's not the same thing. But to understand what he's saying here. And what he's saying in that context is, think about it. So you're the guy on the block that owes everybody something, money. Because you've been borrowing, you're extending yourself, you're borrowing from this guy and this guy and this guy and this guy. And how in the world, what sort of relationship, let's just take it to our 21st century, how many of you are really good friends, have a good relationship with your mortgage broker? I mean, you guys hang out on the weekends, barbecues together. It doesn't happen. I mean, it can if your friend is a mortgage broker, I suppose, already previously. But what's the idea there? There's two sorts of relationships, right? There's this business relationship. And then there's that friendship relationship. And there's a reason why there's often a divide between them. There's a reason why it's not good. It is bad. It is a bad idea. Most people who have lived for any length of time into their adulthood realize it's really a bad idea to borrow money from family and friends, right? Why do we, without any biblical reference, why do we say that? Okay, has the potential for damage, right? This is what he's talking about here. He's saying, listen, earthly things has the potential to damage something more important. So what do you automatically owe your neighbor? Carol mentioned, what do you as a Christian automatically owe your neighbor because the law says it? What do you owe your neighbor? You owe him love. You owe him your love. So if you owe him your money, it hinders your ability to pay him your love. To give him your love. It's just talking about that concept as a Christian that we have, where we have, just with the government issues in the first part of chapter 13 and this issue, it's that we have a higher citizenship. We have a higher calling than the rest of the world has. We have a greater responsibility. We are not just here to make money and get stuff and retire and die. It's not what we're here for. We are here for gospel reason. That's why he left us here, right? Great Commission reasons. That's why he left us here. We are here to love. And that's hard to do when other things take priority. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who has loved another has fulfilled the law. Or in other words, what he has done, he has fulfilled the law. He has brought it to its desired end. That's often the way the word is used throughout the book of Matthew when I went through that last couple years ago, the idea of fulfillment, the way it, bringing it to its desired end, its full purpose, its intention for you. You are living intentionally as God created you when you give the love that you owe to your neighbor. Okay, so now he's going to list these out. How do you love your neighbor then? If I were to ask you, how should you love your neighbor? Probably many people, their first response would be good stuff like, well, I should care for them when they're going through hard times, right? Maybe take them a meal. I should preach the gospel to them. I should, mow their lawn, maybe help them out. You know, when I see them struggling, we would list all these really good things that are truly demonstrations of love. What I find most interesting about what the Apostle Paul does here is he jumps from the idea of loving your neighbor, fulfilling the law, he jumps to what you shouldn't do. Now, we don't usually think of it that way, do we? We don't usually think of loving someone as what I'm not going to do to them. But that's what he does here. Now, I'm not saying that those positive what you should do, that's not right. Same thing, what I've said before. Paul's not, there's other places where he would say such things and where the scripture says such things. But here, what does he list as how we love our neighbors? What's the first thing he said you should or should not do if you love your neighbor, to love your neighbor? What's that? Okay, let's just spell it out. What does it say, like, in detail? Okay, don't go after the wife or husband. Don't commit adultery with them. Now, we say, well, of course, but do we live in a culture where that happens a lot? We live in a rampant, immoral culture where people don't understand that that is the opposite of love. Okay, what's the second one he says? And we're gonna see that this is kind of shocking, and I think, what's the second one? So don't kill him. Now, I'm going to remind you again, this isn't the only way we don't love our neighbor. Well, I did. I loved him. I could have, but I didn't today. You should be thankful I love you. Yeah, so, right. So the scripture would say the definition of neighbor is the near one. And the reason why it says neighbor means near one, and like Jesus when he tells the parable of, ask who is my neighbor, they ask who is my neighbor, and he tells the parable of the Samaritan. He tells that in such a way that it's the idea that our neighbor changes constantly. Right now, while you're sitting here, your neighbor are these people, right? And then when you get in your car and you drive home, or you're driving home, your neighbors become all the people in the driving along with you. And when you get home, your neighbor becomes your family and the people living next to you. And when you go to the store, the neighbor is the people in the front of the line and behind the line and around you. The idea that it's all people, but that is it, the reason why I use near one is if we just say all people, it becomes very easy for us to be like, well, I love the people over in Africa and I love the people over there. But it's the idea is it's a very practical sense. Like, but do you love the person standing right next to you? The person who cut you off, the person who did that, like the near one, the one you can. That's the story of the Good Samaritan. The neighbor was the Samaritan because there was one he came next to and he had need and he loved him. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. This is not only reflecting Jesus' teaching, it's doing both. Moses and Jesus, right? He's addressing both Christ who gave the command about love God and love your neighbor as yourself, and then also how Jesus himself went back to the Ten Commandments, the moral law, to describe this. Okay, so you shouldn't murder. Now, Jesus also clarified, right? And both of these, right? Didn't Jesus give a clarifying remarks regarding both of these two right here? Remember those clarifying remarks of what that really means? Right. And by the way, Jesus is not saying that if you hate somebody, you can say, well, I've already done the deed. Might as well follow through physically with it. That's not what he means by that. Some people actually, they wouldn't try to necessarily apply that to the murder, but some people have applied that regarding adultery. Well, I've already lusted. You know, what's the point now? Why not just do the whole thing? So no, he's not saying that they're the exact same thing. That's why in the law, there's even different consequences for them, right? But he is saying before God, you're not guiltless of adultery if you just say, but I didn't actually go through with it physically. He said, you're still guilty before God. Well, I didn't actually kill him. Before God, you're guilty as such because you hated your brother. So yeah, so he clarifies that we're not just talking about the first two he gives here are two of those very clear ones that Jesus clarified. What's the next one? He says, this one, stealing. Don't steal from your neighbor. The next one, lying. Or lying is what bear false witness means. And I think that's like all of these, there is a general definition as well as a particular definition. In the law, the Mosaic law, bearing false witness was more than just telling a lie. It was lying against your neighbor, lying against somebody, literally in a court where you are testifying against them, false witness. We could apply that slander, gossip. You're against your neighbor. You're speaking against, blaspheming against them. You shall not bear false witness. And then the last one, you shall not covet. Or Paul describes this as being the killer for him in Romans 7. Lust, wanting, desiring, pursuing. So we understand, I think we understand, that the negative commands of the moral law, and this is what Jesus is trying to get across in Matthew, were not minimum requirements. But that's exactly the way the Pharisees addressed them, with loopholes. What can I do to do what I want to do in my flesh without actually having crossed the line into adultery? What do I have to do? How far can I go in hating somebody before I've crossed the line into murdering them? That was the Pharisaical attitude, right? And that's one of the things Jesus is correcting in Matthew. That's why he brings up, well, you crossed the line when you hated. You crossed the line when you lusted, looked with lust. He's trying to address that. What Jesus said with those two can be said about all the moral commands, right? Jesus wasn't just saying only those two. We get that those were examples. So when we think of the moral commands of God for his people, we should not just, although they're given in the negative, we should just not just view them as only minimum requirements in the negative. We have to understand the positive opposite of this is what we ought to then be pursuing in owing our neighbor these things. So not only, and this is an application of it, I want us to think through this, how do we apply verse 9, the first commandment, I owe my neighbor this, right? Verse 8, I owe my neighbor love. Love fulfills the law. The law says this, you shall not commit adultery. So, how do I love my neighbor practically, the near one, whoever that is, everyone and anyone, right? But the near one, how do I love my neighbor by not committing adultery in more than just the bare minimum, as we mentioned before, so I won't, you know, go after their spouse. But how can I apply this where I'm understanding Jesus' intent of the law, as he describes? Yeah, Chris? Okay. Okay. Good. And I'm glad you brought this up about not putting yourself in a position where you could yield to that. I think that's such an important thing. But one of the things we often do is we're even when we see these commands, we often put it in the sense that, in a passive sense, in that, well, it's about me not violating this commandment. But the way he puts it, it's like, no, actually, I am supposed to have a forward-looking attitude toward my neighbor. So I'm glad you brought that up. It's not just, well, I want to make sure I keep myself pure as it relates to my neighbor, but I'm going to do everything I can with my life to protect the purity of my neighbor. I'm going to be proactive in how I handle myself in such a way that not only will I not fall, but they won't fall, that I'm going to try to protect them because I love them in this sense. Right. Yeah. First Peter, right, where we looked at yesterday, they see your good works and they glorify God in the day of visitation. So if I love my neighbor, and like you said, not, yes, it refers to the guy who lives next door, but it's everyone who's near you. If I love my neighbor, truly love them, I'm going to have their eternal good on my heart. Right? And I want to live in such a way today that they will glorify God in the day of judgment rather than face the judgment of God. So conduct yourself sexually speaking, adultery, sexually speaking, in such a way that the one who is nearest you will see it as good and glorify God. What are some other ways in which we might think about loving our neighbor this way? Okay, good. That's the, really, I would change that a little bit, not as you would like to, but as you should be treated, like with the objective commands of God. But yes, how about you shall not murder? I mean, I know, let's start low hanging fruit. No matter how much your neighbor aggravates you, I love them, I will not take their life. Now let's make it a little bit more down to earth besides just, because I mean, that can happen. I was watching a TV show yesterday about the true crime, one of those reports of whatever, you know, about neighbors getting in this fight and argument and guns getting pulled out. I mean, it happens. Okay, we see it on the news, but let's just kind of take that as a given. Don't kill your neighbor. Let's jump it up a little bit, make it a little more applicable. Or causes them to hate us. Like if I love my neighbor, I may not want to, I don't, it's also loving to not live in such a way that they want to kill me, right? To live in such a way that it's not going the other way, to live generously and to live freely so that my neighbor will see the love and glorify God in the day of visitation. It's true. I mean, you know better than I do because I much of my day is spent in the Word of God and in here in the church. But you know very much that the world out there that this is not just low hanging fruit. Like this is very practical stuff, right? Stealing, you shall not steal. Let's not get started on the garbage dumpster. But it is stealing, right? I mean, do we really think, we think that way? Do we think that about it, that I'm loving my neighbor? I can love my neighbor by caring for his privacy and property. Generally speaking, with my neighbor, I'm talking about the literal, like, neighborhood neighbor now. Generally speaking, what I tend to do is if their property is offensive to me, I just complain about it to my wife and then maybe make an anonymous call to the city to come down over there and tell them to strip. But what if I love my neighbor and I care for his person and his property and I love him, what if I went over and did it for him? You know, what if I actually extended myself so that he would glorify God in the day of visitation? To love my neighbor. So these are negative. What my point is, you can take the negative and you can apply it in a positive sense as well. Not just in the do not, but do. Do the opposite. You can do the same thing with bearing false witness, being a truth teller. So, yeah, and there's so many of those little jewels in the Old Testament that kind of are the current cultural outworking of the moral principle. And it's really good to go back and study those, not because we're going to start necessarily doing it exactly, because it's culturally, we're plowing your field in this. I mean, we're not plowing our field, but you get the idea. But we can learn how to apply those things in a way that it expresses the heart of what he is saying here. One of my, I'll just give an illustration, got a shed illustration, animal illustration. I'll give an illustration of one that I came to several years ago. If I step on anybody's toes, just please ignore me a little bit, not too much. So the whole returning the shopping cart thing at Walmart, it would be really nice if they made those a little more convenient, because every time I'm parked, it's like way somewhere else. My wife does a really good job. She finds a parking spot right next to the shopping cart corral. That's her whole goal, is finding one near there. But, you know, I was convicted about that by just leaving my shopping cart. It's silly. That sounds silly. I was convicted about that because you know how Don said, love somebody like you want to be loved? I was convicted about my actions of love when somebody had left a couple shopping carts out and the wind was blowing and it blew it right into my car. And I was like, those people are leaving their shopping cart out. And then it was like, Nathan came to me and said, thou art the man, you know? And I'm like, but I was convicted. And it wasn't a matter of, I was concerned about Walmart or whatever. It was more a matter of, if I love my neighbor and I care about his property and his, then why would I, can I not take those extra few steps to protect his vehicle, though I don't know him yet? To protect perhaps just even knowing the annoyance I have felt when you go to pull into a parking spot, the one left, and it's filled with everybody's shopping carts that gathered in that one, and thought, I can love. I ought to, the whole idea was not just focus on this, do this. It's not legalism. It's let the idea of loving God and loving your neighbor influence your entirety of your life. Even every decision, let it be driven by love. That's his point. Owe no one anything, but owe them love. You fulfill the law in every detail. And that brings up what Lisa mentioned just a second ago. In the Old Testament, there were these laws about these smallest of details. It wasn't to create a legalistic perspective. It was to cause them to see how the two in which all the law hangs, love God, love your neighbor, and how they're applied in every area of life.
Not
right? Good. So as we're out of time, but just let's think about this paragraph that I wanted to mention. By the way, in case we say, well, I'll work on those five, he closes it, this paragraph, with saying, if there is any other commandment, so any others, this is it right here, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. This is how God has called us to live, for his glory and for the gospel advancement in the world, with love as the motivation and the manner of how we live. So let's think about that. And I would challenge you, as I need to do and as I have done in the past, is as you go throughout your normal daily life, asking that question. I've challenged myself with that. And it's made me be a few times letting people merge in front of me a little more. You know, that if I can love them, I should love them. I ought to love them. Okay, then what does it matter if I get there a minute earlier, a minute later? Okay, I can love them. Just letting it affect all of our lives, not having a compartment where we have our sacred and our secular, our Monday through Saturday, and then our Sunday life, where love is the principle throughout the whole thing. All right, we're out of time today. We'll gather together to worship in just a few minutes here. Let's pray.